And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and for the next 2 hours, I'm going to be taking you to the farthest reaches of the solar system with a few friends of mine along for the trip. Friends that, you've met before and you're going to meet again. This is going to be a very interesting show because it's going to be a show about contrast. Remember, I've said that one of the key watchwords of the HD physics hyperdimensional model, torsion field model, is the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. Well, today and yesterday, we have had now quintessential examples of both things. Let me start with the good. I've had a ton of emails over the last 24 hours plus about a certain ex-president named Jimmy Carter. Obviously, you all have noticed that Jimmy Carter at Sunday school on Sunday morning announced kind of quietly and without much fanfare that he seems to be cured of his cancer. And a ton of you have sent me emails saying, "We did it! We did it! We did it!" Now, all right, hold on. Hold on. We don't have enough data yet to know whether we did anything. Over the last few hours, courtesy of Scott, I've had, that's my producer, of course, I've had an opportunity to look at some links and some medical opinions regarding the specific drug, the immunotherapy drug that the president has been taking. And there's a lot of, confusion. That's too hard a term. Ambiguity in exactly what this means. In many patients, tumors do shrink. We are told, if you look at the, if you go to othersideofmidnight.com and go up to the upper right-hand corner, click on Radio with Pictures, that will take you to tonight's show page. In fact, I will do that even now as I speak. And at the very top, link number one, there is a story, a major news story called, well, it's actually the title is, "Here's a Look at Keytruda, the Drug Jimmy Carter Says Made His Tumors Vanish." And if you probe into this particular drug, this immunotherapy drug, you find that it has interesting properties in that it does make tumors shrink, but they come back. And you have to keep taking the drug because it does a very clever kind of end run around the cancer cells' ability to hide from the immune system. And what this drug apparently does is it strips away their ability to kind of mimic invisibility so that the body's immune system goes, "Ah, invaders," and attacks the tumors, and they ultimately go away. Or at least they go away as long as you're taking this particular, drug. Well, we don't know whether or not the consciousness experiments that we performed and have been performing for some months now, just kind of keeping, the president in our thoughts. Mr. Carter, was an incredibly interesting individual. He's 91. He acts like he's 21. He runs around the world, does all these very cool things, trying to help people, building houses, looking at elections. I mean, there's not one area that the president has not been involved in which is not benefited by his presence. Well, an awful lot of people around the world, millions of people, when they heard the shocking news back in August, shortly after this show went on the air, that the president had cancer, and most horribly, cancer of the brain, because it's really hard to operate and remove it, even if you are successful. It's one of those things where the cure may be worse than the disease. We all obviously have been hoping for the best, and so it was staggeringly interesting news to hear on Sunday from President Carter's own lips that he seems to be cured. Now, it's going to take months to figure out whether it's the drug, it's us plus the drug, it's us plus the drug plus millions of people. Remember, I talked about the pilot wave. If we focus, we basically can cohere this hyperdimensional resonance. Regardless of the actual mechanism, I want you to all kind of take a step back. Let's not overhype this. Let's not try to claim something that we can't be sure of, because what would be very significant is if the tumors really are gone, and given the protocols and the fact that other patients have to keep taking the drug for the tumors to remain in check. It's kind of like AIDS, where you take the drug therapy and you never can get rid of the virus, but you can keep it in check now. A far cry from what was happening in the 80s when AIDS first appeared on the scene. So we need to adopt a wait and see attitude about the president. I am obviously hoping that we in fact did have some effect, and the only way we're going to know that is to differentiate the president's prognosis from other patients taking the similar drug. And I want to thank Scott for finding the important info. And so you go to link number one on Radio with Pictures, and there it is. And then, of course, you can Google more and more and more information. And I just kind of find it interesting that at the last news that I saw, the people at the hospital where he has been treated, the doctors apparently are referring all inquiries to the Carter Center and not making any pronouncements yet themselves. So that tells me that they themselves are kind of puzzled by this very rapid, I mean, August to December, that's pretty amazing. So let us think positive. Let's, in fact, think that that we may, in fact, have nudged this process in the right direction. But let's not make any claims, certainly any absolute claims, until we have more scientific data. Now, that's the good. The good are getting better, etc. The bad are getting worse part of the physics is exemplified by Donald Trump today. And I know I'm going to get email. Boy, whenever I mention Donald, I get email. Donald is a fascist. Donald is giving us an eerie replay, almost note for note, of what happened in the 1930s when a particular group of people were singled out and made the other, the scapegoat, the problem. Except he's doing it not with Jews, he's doing it with Muslims. I mean, the absurdity, and it's interesting that many commentators and news people have actually used the words absurd, including some elected representatives today, to represent what Donald Trump, you know, is proposing. He, this afternoon, kind of like a bolt out of the blue, except we had some hints of it 2 or 3 weeks ago when he was asked if he would require Muslims to register on a list, which, of course, is exactly how Hitler began. Apparently, other candidates in the Republican Party are beginning to realize that something is radically amiss. And I guess it was one of the backers of Jeb Bush took out on Sunday in Miami a full-page ad basically comparing Trump to Hitler and Mussolini. Why? I mean, one should never in modern society compare anybody to Hitler and Mussolini, unless the comparison is apt. Well, Trump has done something now. He's crossed the line to where not only is he flirting with the idea of putting Muslims in the United States, U.S. citizens, remember, on lists, but he's also talking now about putting mosques under surveillance, intensive surveillance. That kind of goes back to what used to happen with synagogues. And today, he even trumped himself in that he basically said he wants to exclude immigration from any Muslims from anywhere in the world, including American citizens who, if this law or this executive order is enacted, and that's a long other discussion we don't have time for tonight, U.S. military service personnel who happen to be Muslims, who are overseas, who are part of special forces, or, you know, fighting ISIS in Syria right now, they would be prohibited under Trump's edict from coming home, from coming back. Men and women in uniform who happen to be Muslims would be, I mean, this is nightmarish. This is insanity. This is a replay of the 1930s all over again. And that's not the most disturbing part. The most disturbing part is if you happen to catch Trump's rally this afternoon, there were thousands of people in that auditorium, actually on a ship on the Yorktown, because Trump thought it would be appropriate to hold a rally on one of the aircraft carriers that helped us beat the Japanese, who, of course, attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, just a, you know, an anniversary a few hours ago now. It's now December 8th. It's our show after midnight. But the fact that he is proposing protocols for handling an entire group of people who happen to adhere to a specific religion. I mean, didn't he ever get the memo that the Constitution, the First Amendment, forget the Second, the First Amendment, it's the First Amendment for a reason. It's because you cannot discriminate people's speech, their religion, et cetera, et cetera. And there he is. Now, Donald Trump is not a dumb guy. In fact, he's a very smart guy. So my question is, how many layers of this are we not seeing? How deep does this iceberg go? What is the real agenda here? Does he really think he's going to become elected president of the United States of America when he has something like 30, 35, 36% of the Republican primary electorate, which of course is not representative of the entire Republican Party? It's like one-third. But if you translate that to statistics that apply to general elections, that would mean that in a runoff between a Democratic candidate and Trump, he would get maybe 18, 20, 25%, because that's the representation of these people who are avidly cheering when he basically says, I'm going to outdo Hitler. I'm going to ban 1.5 billion Muslims from ever coming to the United States again. I mean, this is so nuts that it only could happen in a universe where the realities have been completely transposed, that the reality we're now living really belongs in the cartoons and in the Marvel Universe. And when he looked at that little kid in the helicopter back in Iowa in the summer, when the kid asked him, are you Batman? And he said, yes. We are living in some kind of alternate universe. And I am praying, and I don't pray a lot, but I'm praying that the common sense of the American people, the fact that we really value liberty and freedom and justice for all, not just for some, for all, that's what makes us exceptional. The other thing that makes us exceptional is what we're going to talk about tonight, because while all this is going on down here, there's some stunning, staggering stuff going on upstairs at the ends of the solar system, at literally the ultimate thule of the places that we have now, with robotic spacecraft, been able to visit. And the place I'm talking about, of course, is Pluto, because unless there is a significant, huge, major game changer that enters into the body politic and makes everyone reassess who is their brother, who is their cousin, who is related, who is human compared to the ineffable other that's out there, that is demonstrably fascinating in the fact that we're now seeing stunning details of architecture and archaeology on a place that should never have anything. Well, to discuss that tonight and to go through the imagery in detail and the analysis and kind of try to get a grip, a handle on what it might mean in terms of future revelations from NASA, we've assembled our imaging panel tonight, minus Alan Sturm. He was hoping he could make it, and at the last minute he sent me a note and he said, nope, too much stuff stacked up, I can't do it. So we have with us tonight Keith Laney, who is an imaging guy in North Carolina, in Charlotte, as a matter of fact. Husband, father, grandfather, artist, copper master, amateur space scientist, and avid promoter and supporter of exploration, space exploration. And way across the pond is Robert Harrison in Britain this morning. Bob has been with us for all of these sessions. He's done some extraordinary imaging work and analysis going back to the days of Cydonia. And you all are familiar with his particular focus and emphasis now on the arcologies and the architecture of the arcologies we're finding all over the solar system. Then we have Andrew Curry. Andrew is an artist. He is an artist of some note because he can create the most staggeringly interesting representations in art of the imagery that we're going to analyze all within a few hours. And we have one of those up tonight up there in Radio with Pictures, and we're going to go through them in sequence, so don't worry about that now. And last but not least, Will Farrer, who is in Maryland. He has a technological background. He began at a very young age, 16, and is currently information technology director for a national healthcare company, which I guess he doesn't want to mention because maybe they don't want to be associated with a bunch of crazies who think they're seeing architecture on other planets. Gentlemen, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Morning, Richard.
Morning.
Well, where, morning, Richard. Morning. Where do we begin? And who should we begin with? I'll tell you what. Let's start with Keith, because Keith has done some really cool stuff. And actually, we're going to discuss more than just Pluto this morning. We're also going to dip into Ceres. But I think we need to start with Pluto, because Dr. Stern is playing a very interesting inside game. And he has suddenly given us an astonishing, staggering image. And the image actually comes with a little story. I don't know whether, Keith, you want to tell the story. Do you want to tell the story?
No.
You don't want to
tell it. And that's just a beautiful image.
Oh, that's all you want to say?
These are the images that I dreamed of.
What I wanted you to tell the story. Because remember, hyperdimensional physics transcends space and time. So obviously, at some point, you were able to peek into Alan Stern's mind. Alan, if you're listening, be careful.
Well, it was the strangest dream. I wasn't really, much thinking about Pluto images, and it happened a pretty good little while ago. But I was sitting at my desk in this dream, and I was looking at these great big, long, huge strips, just absolutely clear, stunning Pluto. And I mean, it was one of those dreams where you wake up a little bit, and then you go back to sleep, and you dream it again. But this happened to me all night, and I was absolutely riveted to this dream because I love doing this. I love looking at these pictures and exploring these surfaces. And, I was stuck in this dream. And it struck me so much the next morning I woke up. And, I contacted him and told him, hey, I had a dream where I saw these great big images. And he kind of let me know that, yep, we're going to be releasing some of those.
But the difference was you saw on these images, which have now been released, the kind of startling, stunning, astonishing, it should not be there, architectural detail that we're now actually seeing.
Yes. Yes, saw the same sort of thing.
And you told the rest of us. So we know. I mean, Keith is on record. He told me about this dream weeks ago. And so when I saw this image come out, I didn't have to have his email saying, hey, I dreamed this, because I'm looking at the image and I'm thinking, damn it, Keith's got a way to peer into Stern's mind.
Well, I'm not going to take it as I'm going to sit here in a crystal ball and try to scry it, but, I will take what I get.
So where do we want to go first?
Well, we can start out if you want to have a preliminary look at the imaging that I've done. We can start on Radio with Pictures, link number 7.
Link number 7.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, lucky 7.
And that should take you a page that I've got titled Rhyme of Celestial Mirror.
This is so cool. Hey, let me read this, because you write. You are one hell of a writer. There are marvelous tales untold, older than our race, older even than our world. These lie scattered through all our proudest planetary explorations, whispering at us to but open our eyes and see them. They infiltrate the dreams of our most creative of writers and artists, musing incomplete hints of an epic whole greater than any subset of its parts. Like shadows seen hauntingly through an ever-lightening glass, these visible clues, creative notions, and what may even be race memories increasingly hint of things that were and are to come. Staying always on that shaded, blind, or block side of a collective subconscious, which is quite possibly beyond the reach of all but the most excellent and highly proffered tales. Popular culture is replete with such tales, Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica, 2001 A Space Odyssey, or Foundation, to name a few, and to barely scratch the surface. These are perhaps telling us no more or less than easily digestible semi-truths, pieces of a larger, even more fantastic tale made more horrifyingly true because it is our history. Such history as this, not indelibly recorded, becomes our legend, myth, fiction, maybe even religion. So also does that which was incredibly tragic and is thus necessary being dribbled into our psyche slowly for lessened sociological impact. You're a hell of a writer.
Well, I just have to put it like I see it. You know, this. It's, if you're doing something that is right, it just it feels natural to you and it flows.
Well, that's the big picture story. We're looking at ourselves a long, long time ago on a planetary body, not even a galaxy, just a body at the edge of the solar system, far, far away, that appears to have preserved, as I hoped in the book that I wrote, you know, with Grossinger, Pluto, New Horizons for a Lost Horizon, that we would find something, but I never imagined we'd find something so stunningly preserved as this, nor that it would tell us almost the unfolding storyline of what might have happened to leave these awesome ruins in a state where we can actually reconstruct what they might have been.
Yes, yeah, the whole surface of this place is, you know, we kind of got inklings when we got the first images that, you know, kind of gave us a clue that, you know, something's very different about the surface of this planet.
Well, remember Bob Harrison's Trantor side, the side mm-hmm. we didn't get to see? I mean, he's done some pretty good imaging work with what we've got, which was much more distant imagery. And the whole damn surface looks like it's organized geometry, like it's a super, super, super urban complex covering originally the surface of this 1,500-mile diameter world.
Yes. Well, you know, we started out getting, you know, on this page, I've got two of the long strip images. Okay. Now we have the new one that's on the left. It's image number one, and it's not the full strip, but it's the pertinent part that really we're looking at. The top is mostly just plains and craters, and the bottom is just ice dune plains that I chopped off of the image. However, I've taken this and I've blown this up a little bit, and I've sharpened it up somewhat, and this is real good for reference. It's the actual whole thing put together. The one that's on the right is one from from a couple weeks ago, or actually about a month and a half.
Okay, are we on the right page? Because I'm looking at the Rime of Celestial Mariners. Mm-hmm. I scroll down. I get one long strip. I don't get two side-by-side. I get one strip.
You don't have two side-by-side? Okay.
Nope.
Well, okay, then maybe your resolution is set different than ours. The one below it is number two. I've got them numbered, so you can see image number one is a black and white strip. Image number two is a colored strip.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, that's the Lori Ryder image that came out. About a month and a half ago, and you know, we thought it was pieced together from other stuff. It's actually the long strip images that they're making out of these, and it's really notable too. It has a stunning geometry down in it, even though it's not quite as good quality as the newest image that we have. It does have the extra dimension of having color added to it.
Mm.
But I've taken these images, like, you know, when I first looked at the ones that Dr. Stern was displaying, you know, typical to always, those are images done by space guys, satellite guys, scientists, and they just don't, sometimes they don't put that extra pretty picture touch on it. Hmm. You know, they don't take the noise out of it. If you look at image number three.
Scrolling down.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody, by the way, othersideofmidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, radio with pictures. Takes you to tonight's page. You go to 7, link number 7. Click on that. That takes you to Keith's Hidden Mission page, where he's got all these neatly arrayed. And you scroll down on that page to link number 3, which is kind of like a real good close-up of the edge between the jumbled mess and the iceberg-looking ice flows in the lower right-hand corner.
Well, you know, the difference with these, you know, they released a couple of single frame images, and this number three image is one of those single frames. And for some reason, these are way larger than what we've been getting from them. Now, I don't know if that's a factor of the resolution of the photography itself, or if it's just that they've managed, you know, they've seen us blowing up the images trying to see what's in them. Maybe they decided to give us larger images to look into a little better. But however, they still came out a little bit noisy. But on this one, I've cleaned most of the noise out. Now, if you click on it and go into it, you'll see that.
Clicking on three.
Mm-hmm. Click on image three. I've cleaned it up a little.
Gosh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it had a little like
holy
a fine scale noise.
Cow.
Yeah.
And all kinds of other bovines. This is startlingly impossible. This is impossible. Look
well,
at
you,
this
look, is
at, look at all those girders.
Yeah, well, they're, I mean, it's everywhere. If you look, there's structures everywhere in this. But this is just to give you I like to keep clean images so you can look at the whole thing. Because I have some that we can actually get into and look at the structures on it. If you click out of this image.
Mm-hmm. Going back.
And scroll down the page just a little bit, and you'll see the images number 5 and 6.
Okay, going to 5.
And they're single frames as well.
All right.
And actually, they even gave us a scale bar.
Didn't they?
Yeah, on image 5, we have a scale bar, and it's accurate for both of these images. Really, I probably should have transposed it onto the other image to mm-hmm. give it on image. But you know, suffice it to say, you know that when you click on this zoom image, that a couple inches of it, 3 inches or so, is 6 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So that they're not as high resolution as say our mock camera, but.
When you say mock camera, you mean
Mars? Yeah, the old Mars
orbital camera on Mars Surveyor.
Right, that's no longer functioning, but which gave us thousands of nice images to cut our teeth on back in the day.
In fact, I think the resolution per pixel is, they said, about half a city block.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you can see you got the scale bar on there. So that kind of takes a little bit of the mystery of the scale of what we're seeing here, and it also lets us know that the things that we're seeing that are really defined are probably actually what we're seeing, what is on the surface and in that shape. It's, in other words, it's not that zoomed out that you can't tell the details.
No.
Yeah. But if you click on that image,
number 6 or 5,
mm-hmm, number 5.
Number 5. Okay, clicking on 5.
That's the northern part of that area, and yes, I think this is just as stunning as the large broken pieces that are in Sputnik Planum. If you look, I've got it numbered, and I've got like a number 1, you saw orange number 1, it's in the top left hand of the image.
It's kind of in the center of the image.
Yeah, in the center image on the left side.
Mm-hmm. Now, that you can click on it, you can actually click on it, oh my God, because I saw this in the raw, and I said, wait a minute. Glacial geology on mountains on Pluto does not produce vast, you know, linear slabs or plates that are sitting upright, sticking out of stuff.
And those plates are all over. I mean, they're all over all of this. But the ones that stick out are the ones like this one that are on top of a mountain.
Which may be a clue to the process of why we're seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if it's on the top, it means stuff is sloughed off like avalanches and is revealing what's underneath the ice.
Yes, could be.
And the ices we're looking at, by the way, are nitrogen, not water. Nitrogen ice, an amazing idea at these temperatures.
Yes.
What in the world happened here? What happened to these people? And there are so many people who must have died. I mean, we're making a big deal, and I'm going to get an email on this. You know, a few people here, a few people there. In this catastrophic war, billions, if not trillions, of people must have died in this catastrophe, almost simultaneously.
Yeah, whatever hit this place hit it hard. It's no doubt about that.
And remember, this is only the outpost that's been preserved. The rest of the inner solar system, if our calculations are correct, the same thing happened, and of course it's all been wiped away. I mean, the degree of preservation, as I hoped, you know, back in March when I wrote that thing for the Pluto book, is staggeringly better than even I hoped. When you look at some of the imagery of Triton, And in the book, you know, I have some plates of Triton. The Voyager took close-ups of as it flew by back in 89. You get hints of archaeology, but nothing like this. I mean, this is just overwhelming, and there's a huge 3D component to it. These things are sticking miles up in the air. Whatever there is left.
This place is wrecked over and then iced over on top of it.
Yep.
And has been that way through a constant freeze and thaw cycle for millennia as Pluto's gone on its erratic little way around our solar system.
Well, if we're right, it's gone this way for 65 million years, if that's the date when all this happened.
Sure has. But then if you go down to right of that number one, mm-hmm. you'll see a number two, and there are... it's pretty self-explanatory what's around it. Right, left of the number two,
mm-hmm.
there's something, you know, I've heard people say that's the spider. Mm. I don't know what it is, but it's a bunch of little triangles that look like windows that are on a superstructure, on like sort of a semi-dome superstructure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the skeleton of some type of dome building that was once there. I don't know what it is, but I know it sure draws your eye. And the area around it is very linear, too. It's sort of like what Bob's talking about. The edge of that's the edge of a Trantor surface. It looks like an exposed edge of constructed material.
Hmm.
And you can see, if you follow it all the way over to three...
Okay,
that whole little area that's in there.
Oh, look at that!
Yeah, it's built up, and you know the thing about these images are it takes a while.
Oh, look at that cone with the geometry on it, right to the right of your number three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was hard for me to pinpoint an exact place to put these little numbers at to decide. So I just kind of decided to put them in a medium.
Because there's stuff everywhere. It's like you could put a number anywhere and see something interesting. There isn't a speck of the surface that isn't artificial and jumbled and destroyed and smashed. And what I found interesting, and maybe we should bring in Bob to tell us what his theory is, because you and I are thinking that we're looking at jumbled arcologies that were jostled together, and jostled is not the correct term, under these, you know, incredibly catastrophic conditions, but kind of smashed together. I use the analogy of the... 16th century Spanish Armada, when it got caught in the hurricane and when they were trying to get at the English fleet. But Bob has another idea. Bob, you want to come in and tell us what your idea is?
Right. Well, if people go back to Radio of Pictures.
Okay, all the way back to Radio of Pictures.
Right, and click on image number four.
Number four.
Which is a map image.
Ah, there's a map. Good thinking.
Right.
And the map is pretty high definition. The thumbnail on the Radio with Pictures page is kind of lousy, but the good image is very, very revealing. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, this is just showing the area that these two image strips are covering, which is within the red oval. So you can see along the... east shore line, as we'd call it, of the Sputnik Plain, we've got the proposed archaeology ruins that we've talked about over recent months.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other shore, we've got the Dragon Scales area. So this is up in the northeast area of Sputnik Planum. Now,
you mean where you have the red oval?
Where the red oval is. And
that's the area of the high-resolution strips that Keith's been talking about.
Yes, that's right. So the Sputnik Plain seems to have been created by some heat event, which has created a massive...
Well, you do remember what the center coordinates of the Sputnik Planum are, don't you?
Well, 19.5 is...
You got it. So if there was an upwelling, if something energetically happened to Pluto, and there was an incredible upwelling from the core, and it came up at 19.5 and melted... a huge amount of stuff, or just disturbed an ocean that was already liquid. We don't know what the temperatures back when all this was occupied would have been, but it could have created a tsunami that would have rippled out from that point, that 19.5 point, and would have caused catastrophic destruction in a circular ring going outward from the center all around the shoreline of this ancient, can I say sea?
We'll call it a sea, yes.
Okay.
But it's like the sea, at the moment, it's like the seas on the moon, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's frozen lava plains there. It's frozen
By the way,
nitrogen
guys,
and everything plains.
Let me just tell Keith, I blew past the break at the bottom of the hour because I was too fascinated by Keith's description of what we're seeing. So we will do one at the top of the hour, but continue, Robert.
Right. Well, in this area, we'll call it the mantle under the crust of Pluto, seems to have warmed up and turned to slushy liquid too, causing the top crust above it to break up, into like a field of icebergs.
Mm-hmm.
Like
tabular icebergs.
Yes, like like the carving of mass carving of icebergs off a glacier. So you've got this jumble of with a glacier, when it breaks up at the sea, you start off with a flat surface, then it breaks up, all the ice flows and icebergs roll into their position of balance, and everything turns up pointy, crazy angles. It might completely capsize, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the sort of scenario I have for this particular area, what's happened. So there might... So I'm seeing this as being mostly flat. There might be a few arcologies that were bobbing along as this all broke up in whatever liquid it was.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect it would probably be mostly liquid or slushy water, because that's what I suspect is underneath all that frozen nitrogen of the planet.
Well, see, to me, Pluto, even back when we first got the first data from Earth, that it was kind of like a Triton, which has a nitrogen atmosphere but a lot of nitrogen ices, it occurred to me that if we were to take the Earth and we were to move it from where we are, 1 AU from the Sun, 93 million miles, out to Pluto, the atmosphere would freeze. And 80% of our atmosphere is nitrogen. So the air would literally coat the ground as fields of snow and ice made mostly of nitrogen. And that's what this place looks like if Pluto did not always reside at the edge of the solar system, and this incredible Type II civilization, which casually built cities, dome cities, tens of miles across and miles high, had the ability to move planets. I know it sounds insane, but all you have to do is control mass and gravity, inertia and gravity, and you're home free, and the torsion field model allows you to do that. And we actually have examples of lab experiments where inertia can be changed, gravity can be changed. So give us another 100 years and we'll be moving planets if we want to.
Even without anti-gravity, if you've got enough time, you can use slingshot.
That's not what they did. You know that's not what they did.
No, I think it would. If they had the technology, you would avoid that method.
Yep.
So,
Well, look, the EM drive has got to be something like this. It's got to be a way of nullifying inertia so that you're able to move without expelling rocket thrust an object, and you hook a number of them up, and you can take something and move it anywhere.
Hmm. So where should we proceed now?
Well, you were making an analogy with me in email a couple of days ago. You felt that if people have seen the movie 2012, there's a scene, and if you go to Radio with Pictures and you scroll down just under Image 5, I don't know why it doesn't have its own number, but look at that thing that says 2012 and click on it. And that will I see it is part of number 5, okay?
It is, yes.
Yeah, but we can enlarge it by clicking on it again, and your caption says, "Note the similarities between the 3D rectilinear structures of the Pluto slabs and the 2012 Los Angeles slab that was seen in the movie."
Yes, the analogy I'm making here is this poster concentrates on some of these gigantic icebergs that have remained with the flat surface uppermost, and the this sort of turmoil that has happened in this region is shaking the surface of these slabs and allowed us to see what was probably what seems to have been under the surface, which is an underground and perhaps low-rise version of the Trantor City idea, the idea that Pluto is covered with, almost completely covered with artificial structures, a huge planet-wide city. And the top of these slabs are covered with, etched surfaces, embossed surfaces, which are very geometric.
Yep. The key to all this, Robert, is the geometry. Natural surfaces don't look geometric like this stuff does, mile after mile after mile after mile.
So the analogy here is we go back down to where I've rotated it, so we can more easily see the geometry. This particular slab.
That's beautiful. Look at that.
Again,
let me tell people where to go. Othersideofmidnight.com, upper right-hand corner, radio with pictures. Click on that. That takes you to tonight's guest page. And if you click on number 5, that will take you to this strip. You click on it again. You can scroll up and down. It's highly magnified. And what Robert has done is to compare the Pluto color strip image with this stunning rectilinear geometry, which in the third or fourth plate he's rotated so you can see it. Because there are experiments with cats that show that if you rotate things at the wrong angle, cats can't see geometry. But if you rotate it to the right angle, the geometry leaps out. And since cats are our closest non-primate relatives, you guys didn't know that, did you? We share the same geometric thing. So when you see a picture, a space image, try rotating it around until the geometry pops out at you, because there are certain angles where you'll see it and other angles where you won't.
Well, this might sound a little crazy, but I find if you just move your head a little bit...
Well, you can rotate your head, sure.
But if your head is in movement, often geometry in these images just seems to be easier to see.
Yep. Well, that's why.
Or maybe I'm just more cat or something. So this final rotated image, this particular slab is well coated with Pluto's red stuff, which is settled into the lower areas mostly.
Do you wonder what the red stuff is, like I do?
I know you've got your own idea there. The paler areas are usually higher, and they're quite wall-like and geometrical. You've got walls meeting, and you've got like right angles.
There's no way this is natural.
It's quite maze-like in places. So the 2012 comparison is, of course, in the film, in this jolly happy film, the surface of the crust of Los Angeles breaks up into these slabs, which settle into crazy angles, but the top surface of each has still got the geometrical city plan with the streets and the buildings. So that's the kind of analogy of geometrical structures still existing, artificial geometrical structures still existing on both slabs. I suppose the natural idea that people would come up with was, perhaps the ice on Pluto just... Excuse me a moment. The ice on Pluto just naturally evaporates into these smashing, geometrical designs. But
No.
Mm,
no.
Yes.
No. That's the mainstream desperately reaching for a mainstream answer when the answer is not mainstream yet. But it will be. How can this photography be sent around the world and there not be bright people who look at this and say, oh my God, somebody built this?
Richard, if I might say something about that, I've been watching trending all night on Pluto, has been trending on Facebook.
This is Will Farrer, who was speaking from Maryland.
Good old Maryland here. And looks like about 7 o'clock last night or tonight, wherever way you're looking at it, they posted, NASA put out a picture talking about Pluto. Did you check? Have you seen the close-up image? And looking through the comments on there, there are about 200 and something comments, and the back and forth between people talking about the structures and the way things look. I haven't seen this on NASA comments. You get a comment where somebody's actually talking about it very intellectually, as we are, Knight and Bob is, and Keith is, and it's amazing to actually see that on a page where NASA's actually put it out. And there, of course, you get your first people to say, oh, you're crazy, go take your meds, but then right under that, there's more people that say, no, take a look at that again. And just to add that to the conversation, I thought that was pretty
interesting.
Will,
that's a very important political point, because none of this is going to mean anything until we have the political breakthrough where it goes viral and people start saying, good God, look at what's there. I'm very suspicious, because it looks to me from what you just described that NASA itself is quietly stimulating that conversation. Like it's time.
And it's up to 300 comments, and, you know, 9,800 likes. So it's pretty amazing that the conversation is finally being brought out into the open. It may take pictures like this from somewhere far off to do it. The Mars pictures couldn't do it. The moon pictures couldn't do it. It might just be something so out of our realm.
Well, in all fairness, the Mars and the Moon pictures do not have the stunning redundant geometry that we're seeing here. I mean, this is just incredibly preserved and incredibly. I mean, one of course now wishes that we had, you know, images that were 10 or 100 times better, and we will not from this mission. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Keith, but I think that this strip that Stern released is just about close to the best resolution we will be getting.
Correct.
Richard?
Yeah.
Can I ask Will a question?
Oh, Andrew. Yes, Andrew Curry, by all means, from Canada.
Yeah, hey. Will, how you doing?
Good.
Oh, good, man. What time did you say – did you say that NASA released a single image that everybody was commenting on at 7 o'clock last night? Is that what you said?
It says yesterday. It was Monday at 7:17 p.m. If you go to their Facebook page, they re-released it. The one that has the 6 miles up in the top left-hand corner, it's the black and white version. Just a small little strip of it. And it said, did you miss the close-up view of Pluto? Check out these images sent back from our New Horizons spacecraft.
So they're really underlining it. And as Arlo Guthrie said, they're putting arrows and circles on the back so they really can get people talking.
Because last night, Will. Last night, I tweeted out that we were all meeting together on other side of midnight to do an analysis of this, and I hashtagged NASA. Who knows?
So you're thinking maybe what they're doing is in response to what we were planning to do?
Well, it's just curious because it was about that time.
That special?
Yeah.
All right, as long as you're here, why don't you take us to number 8? Remember, othersideofmidnight.com, radio with pictures, scroll down, number 8, because this is another amazing Andrew Curry representation of what we would see if we were there in a spacesuit with the heaters turned up full.
Oh, thanks, Richard. So a couple of months ago, when you put us together for the first time, Richard, I think it was the Ceres Pluto special. And towards the end, we were out sort of talking about these big arcologies and how we could get closer. And we were talking about flybys. And I made the bold statement, I want to go inside. And this is when we first looked at this, and it was a comment that Alan made too, was that at first it's so confusing and it's too much for the eye to handle and the brain to process. But the moment you, like Keith says, you spend some time, you go in, you do a little walkabout, and then the stuff starts to pop out. And this is what I did. So I tried to imagine this might be a little bit abstract for some people if you're not sort of attuned to what we're looking at. But this is exactly in the arcology that Bob was talking about. So I'm looking at it at the big arcology that he was showing, and I'm making an image where we see like the remnants of the dome, whatever it's made out of, is just collapsed inwards, and we're staring at that sort of arrowhead arcology that's collapsed way off in the distance. Now, I'm taking big liberties here. I mean, obviously the arcology in the background would be much, much bigger, but I wanted to show more background. And I wanted to show light coming through, because we had talked about in the show after the first time we got together about how the walls are translucent. So there's a lot of light coming through on the right-hand side. Now, I don't think the sun would ever be that intense, but I'm taking, of course, artistic license to just give the sense that
actually you'd be amazed at how bright the sun is out there. It may be 3 billion miles from the sun, but 3 billion and change, but it's still the overwhelming bright landscape. In other words, it would be as bright as a bright cloudy day here on Earth.
Okay. Yeah, and maybe it's enhanced by whatever that material is that we're speculating these arcologies are covered by. You know, whatever that might be. So that's what I did here is I tried to give a sense of as if we're up on a perch somewhere, you know, somewhere on a building. And again, one thing I've noticed that we've talked about this is that there's such a familiarity about the construction. You know, we keep talking about roads, about like a city, like almost an urban layout. And so I've picked up on sort of familiar objects. But of course, in a domed arcology that is beyond the physics that we presently accept. So that's kind of where I was coming from with this image, to just give people a little bit of a sense of what we might, you know, and big speculation of what we might be seeing if we were down a little lower, skimming over the top of this thing. And there you go.
Mm. That's stunning, Andrew.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I think you've captured it. I mean, you know, for those of us that have kind of educated eyes that have been looking at this stuff for a long time, when we look at the imagery, like number 7, or, you know, what Bob is showing us up at number 5, we can see all this. But for people who don't spend the amount of time, and I would recommend strongly that when we get off the air, you guys continue to look. Go back and forth, compare, click back, click forward, click back. The more you look, the more you will see. And then there will be that moment when you'll go, oh my God.
Yeah, no, it's a stunning thing. And it's the really interesting thing is, you guys, is the scale of this thing. Like, the more I sort of imagine and place myself. Oh, and by the way, talking about dreams, Richard, mm-hmm. The other night I was asleep and I had this incredibly growing vivid dream of being in the Akator crater and getting very, very close to...
Now, just for people who don't know, we've left Pluto. Akator is a major crater, again, at 19.5, on the little place called Ceres that Will is going to talk about in the next hour after we come to the top of the hour.
Yeah, and it was just really interesting because I was literally descending into this thing, and just before I arrived where I wanted to be, I woke up. But so,
oh, that's terrible. That's happened to me actually. You know, and you try to go back to sleep so you can finish the dream to see what happens.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I'm with you. I think the more time we spend just looking, I think people will dream about this and will feel it. And who knows, maybe even have, like what Keith wrote and what you talk about, Richard, memories. You know, they may come out.
Well, see, this is what's so interesting about what Keith wrote and then what I didn't know that Will just told us about a moment ago, that NASA's encouraging avid, absolutely off-the-wall speculation about this stuff. It's like, look, Brookings always said that the biggest problem is going to be if you hit people between the eyes with the reality we're not alone, they will freak out. And there's enough freaking out on the world today. But if you give people clues and you give them permission, it's like it's on an official NASA site. You're allowed to speculate. You're allowed to see things. People say, oh, come on, you're crazy. Other people say, no, I see this, I see. That's the curve of disclosure. I call it creeping disclosure. I keep saying last night because, you know, it feels like night even though it's morning here. Sunday night, the President of the United States made a major address. And it was all about ISIS and terrorism and Paris and San Bernardino and all that. And the analysts, you know, the next morning, starting on with Morning Joe on MSNBC at 4 o'clock in the morning here, ripped him to shreds. They were expecting, you know, an FDR, you know, we're going to fight him here, we're going to fight him there. You know, they're hauling out comments by Hillary Clinton, we're going to fight him in the air, we're going to fight him on the ground, echoing Churchill and all that. And today, or actually yesterday, was the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And one of the commentators said, it almost looked as if the president was stalling for time. Can you imagine if there is actually, at the White House level, an official announcement being carefully crafted which will take control of the conversation in ways that nobody on this planet can imagine, with the documentation, with the science, with the actual mechanisms laid out so that people can figure this out, that no, this is not fiction, this is not a movie, this is for real. Is this what the president is stalling for time so that we not only completely upend the whole ISIS conversation and, you know, banning Muslims and putting people on lists and all that crap, but we're going to suddenly be connected to our real history, our real selves, and history starts anew. And it could be that the NASA stuff, Will, that you're seeing is part of that developing strategy. And remember, I've said publicly now that sometime in the next year, the physics says in the next year, this could hit the, you know, the rotating kitchen appliance in a big way. Is it possible that's what the president is waiting for, so the conversation is radically changed and we basically outflank? Because the problem we're having with ISIS is not military, it's ideological. It's how do you take control of the conversation so people think much bigger thoughts than they realize against this backdrop of this horrific event that happened in our dim and distant past? We are all so closely related compared to what's out there. Because remember, if there was a war, there had to be two sides. Is the other side still out there?
Quite possibly, Richard.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to kind of bring this to where the rubber meets the road, because this is not being done in a vacuum. We are being prepared. Gentlemen, I hope you agree, and Will has given us the ammo. We are being obviously prepared for something. The clock is ticking, and I don't think we've got a lot more time to wait till the future is stunningly upon us. And we are at the top of the hour. I'm not going to miss this break, okay? So everybody think about that. And while we think about that, let's hear a little bit of Clive Wright, because it seems to me it's very appropriate. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we will return. We are back. My guests this morning, Robert Harrison, Andrew Curry, Will Farrer, and Keith Laney, with our faithful and producer waiting in the wings in the back room, sending me little messages of things that I need to remember and pay attention to. Gentlemen, where were we? I actually, again, I get kind of trapped in the time warp of looking at something that happened millions of years ago that's been preserved. Someone's giving me an echo. Why am I getting an echo? Thank you. Has been preserved almost like it happened yesterday.
Well, Richard, Scott brought up something about my crater dream.
Okay.
He messaged us in the break and said, "Crater, to see a crater in your dream indicates that aspects of your subconscious are being slowly revealed to you. This dream symbol is also symbolic of past memories and experiences."
Well, actually, that could easily fit.
Yeah.
I mean, Keith, you nail it in your opening piece, in the opening paragraph. There's an awful lot of people that if we do this right, if we introduce it to them correctly, they may actually connect with memories of when they were there.
Sure. It's like we were talking about last show or over several shows, actually, about this collective block that's on people. You know, the there's no such thing. You're just crazy people that are just in total denial. I think it's something beyond sociological. I think it's psychological. It's some kind of block in there. Like you said, it's a tragic memory that they don't want to remember. You know, it might bring it back. I really don't know. We face this kind of opposition all along. All I can say is, hey, I see it. I look at it, and I can identify it and bring it up to you up close and show it to you. So it must be something to it.
Okay, who wants to talk about what's in link number 6?
I did. It was when we were looking at those images on the page.
So let me do this. Go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, upper right-hand corner.
Number 7.
Scroll down to, I was going to number 6. You know, number 6 looks very interesting.
Oh, okay. Wait.
Okay, let's see what's on number 6.
Well, that'll be Bob's.
Oh, is that Bob?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, like, what I'll show you is the same thing. It's not the exact same areas, but you'll see these because they're right beside the stuff that I've also delineated off the image.
Yeah, Bob, you want to take us through number 6? Unmuting your mic would help.
I'll just go through this. I think you must have telepathically heard what I said.
Yeah, I'm getting kind of good at that. Okay.
Right. So the black and white image we're looking at today, which is this latest image, it's an oblique. It's a slightly oblique view. So we're seeing sides as well as tops of this broken up area.
Well, as the spacecraft flew by, they took a strip from the horizon, which I don't think is any of the images we have up tonight, all the way down past the nadir. So the spacecraft rotated probably, let me see, how big at 10,000 miles would Pluto have appeared? 1,500 miles across? Come on, somebody do the math. It's several degrees. So, yeah, you're looking at perspectives near the horizon, and then it gets progressively shallower. So this stuff, if it's not right under the spacecraft, you're looking at it kind of from a sideways point of view.
That's right. So if we just scroll down to the bottom, the very bottom image there is a reduced context to show what we've got. And if we just go above that, there's an area that linked by a red arrow. And it's two of the blocks, and the top block, we can see the side of it, and you've got like floor levels almost exposed.
Well, you know, New York City is like an iceberg. New York City is 90% underground. If you could actually see New York in a cutaway, you'd have ground, skyscrapers sticking up, and then you have all this stuff going hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet down. So if you were to rip Manhattan from, you know, the mantle and toss it out into the ocean and freeze the ocean and have, you know, Manhattan sticking kind of at an angle up, and then you took a spacecraft view of it, this is kind of what you'd see. You'd see those levels, you know, if we're thinking of a ship, it would be decks. But in this case, it appears to be structural floors or something, but on a massive scale, huge scale.
As well as the horizontal elements, there mm-hmm. seem to be vertical ones as well.
Yep.
So we've got like lines of caves, shallow caves going into that block.
And again, they're geometric. Geology does not do this, everybody. Geology cannot do this. This is architecture. This is ancient, stunning, type 2 civilization type architecture.
And then to the right side of those sort of floor areas in the middle of that image, there's like a huge long pit, which seems very odd.
Mm.
So going down to the big block below it, you've got like patterns on the top, like raised walls, large raised walls. And you've got that front piece where you're seeing into like caves again in the front center of it.
Is this the image number 3 in your strip?
This is the third one down, yes, we're talking about.
Good. Well, see, I have to keep everybody in mind out there because everybody who's listening has a screen. And if you look at this on your screen, if you magnify it, with a little finger trick, you're going to be staggered by what you're going to see. You're not looking at mountains. You're not looking at ice mountains, which is NASA's standard, disclaimer. Oh, ice mountains rafting around. Yeah, sure.
Right. So there's a green arrow now going from that bottom contact. So
I like the way you arrange this, by the way. It's very elegant and very easy to read.
Right. So this shows an area between the blocks where you've got all this, the smaller blocks where everything's torn apart. And you find on the sides a lot of these blocks and in these sort of intervening areas, there's a great suggestion of like wreckage. It's all this
like what?
Wreckage.
Oh, wreckage. Okay.
So in this particular area at the top, between the blocks. Now it's a jumble, but if you look at the lighter parts of it, there's sinuous white lines that are sort of threading their way through the jumbles, almost like cables.
Or spaghetti. This looks like spaghetti. Yeah. When I make spaghetti and I lay it out on the calendar, there it is.
So,
needless to say, geology doesn't make spaghetti.
So you're wondering what is that? it's almost like I don't know what it could be. It's got to be massive at this scale, whatever it is in width.
Well, given that if you scroll all the way to the bottom now and you notice where it is, it's between blocks. Mm. I think that's where things were really smashed together, and so you're seeing the most resistant elements, structural elements. And, of course, they're the super girders. They have to be big, and they have to be long, and they have to be structurally, high strength. Mm-hmm. And they would survive when all the smaller stuff would be smashed and ground to dust. Those structural elements might survive between collisions between arcologies or between the blocks of your Trantor model.
Mm. Another possibility is that these are tubular tunnels, in other words, not tunneled through something exactly, but like a pipe. But so they could have been linear habitation, embedded below the surface, or they could have been part of a transport system.
Or more prosaic, maybe plumbing.
Possibly, yes.
If you have millions of people living in a city, an awful lot of stuff has to run on plumbing. Without plumbing, you don't have to have a civilization. So if the plumbing is kind of like the last thing that goes because it's so long, contiguous, and it's strong, and it's kind of embedded in the core of these edifices, maybe that's what we're seeing. Pipes.
Quite possibly.
Conduits.
They're very cable-like, anyway.
Well, at this resolution, but, we could have better resolution. Oh, that would be so nice. Not on this. Keith is laughing, yes. Come on, admit it. You want better resolution, too.
Oh, I would love it. I would love it if we had high-rise over it.
Wouldn't that be?
Yeah.
Well, if, you know, Dissler and his models work, ultimately, who knows? Who knows?
So we go back to...
Now, that wasn't supposed Radio. To do that. Sorry about that.
We go back to Radio of Pictures. Keith can enlighten us on some of the other stuff that's in there.
Yes, because that image in particular is... it's just amazing, and it took a little while, like it does with all these. You have to let your mind grasp it. You know, I look.
Hang on. We want to go back to Radio with Pictures. Mm-hmm. Hit number 7. That will take us to the Rime of Celestial Mariners. I love your titling, and very good titling. And then we scroll down. How far?
Go down to image 6. It's the very last bottom.
Way at the bottom. Okay, mm-hmm. There we are.
And click on that image, and it brings up a numbered version.
Okay, got it.
Okay, and I did this one just like the other one. The one is on the left, and I saw the same thing that Bob did. See the number 1?
Mm-hmm.
It's right there. If you notice the large arcology or block or whatever that this is on. Oh, and mind you, I agree with Bob on this. I'm thinking we're seeing a combination of a bunch of things here. We're seeing that the flipped up plates, like mm-hmm. he's talking about,
mm-hmm.
and we're seeing arcologies that did not move and their components were strewn all over this pile of stuff, and I'm seeing what could possibly be even starships or large ships.
I know you said that a couple of days ago. Now tell me, how can you tell a starship from 10,000 miles up?
Yeah, it's a big starship, you know. And the
and how do you know these guys had Starflight?
Well, it would make sense to me that they had Starflight. You know what? I look at Pluto as, you know, that maybe this is where they built them. Because wouldn't that make sense if you mm-hmm. were a civilization like that and you were building things like this? Wouldn't you put your starport, the furthest out, in your solar system?
No, but you're missing the big part of the model. The reason this stuff is preserved is because it was moved. I mean, at 3 billion miles, I don't care what kind of technology, you're not going to have a nice, fluffy, nitrogen-rich atmosphere. And that's such a waste of energy. But if you were able to, you know, have it much closer to the sun, like, let's say, the asteroid belt, like where Ceres is, and we're going to come, Will, to Ceres, don't worry. And then after the catastrophe, they moved it, or maybe just before, then you can see that you would have something that was kind of located within the system as opposed to very far away. If you're going to have a port or a facility... and you have, you know, stuff going on, building things, you want it to be accessible. Even with, you know, exotic technology, putting it 3 billion miles away makes no practical sense because it's hard to get there. Regardless of your technology, it's just, it's time, it's energy, you know, time is money, that kind of thing. So why would you put it way out there unless you, as a last gasp, you put it way out there to show those that would come after, like us, what happened?
Yeah, well, that could be. And, you know, so the thing about it is...
I have not convinced you. Okay.
Well, all we have is this great big... all we have is a great big mystery, a great big puzzle. You know, this is a 10 million piece jigsaw puzzle that's just thrown all over the surface of this planet.
Yeah, and we need to find the library.
Right. Well, you know, and so right now, you know, no matter how we speculate on it...
Look at that thing, catty corners to number 3. If you go in the upper... like 45 degrees from your number 3,
mm-hmm.
that next thing, look at that geometry. Look at the...
number 4?
No. Upper left, not right.
Okay.
Just the one right next to it, like at about 40... let's use clocks. At about 10 o'clock
mm-hmm.
from number 3, look at that.
Yeah, well, that whole thing, if you look at number 2, that whole thing is one thing. That is one thing. You know what I think is the most curious thing on this entire image is if you look at the 2 o'clock position from number 2.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. This is a multi-layered surface with some kind of a doily looking thing on top of it, like it's broken off of one of these pieces and rolled over there and stuck mm-hmm. into the side of that hill.
And it's all huge. The scale of this is absolutely, pardon the pun. Astronomical.
That thing's a mile long, you know. It's a mile long, and it's if you look at it, it's a good 3/4 of a mile tall, at least.
You know, I'm actually warming to Bob's idea, which, considering the temperatures on Pluto, is significant. I do think we're looking at a combination, Bob, of arcologies and then the base level of Trantor-type, you know, structure. And if something really bad happened in this area, you jumble them together.
If you look at number four, there's another one of the most curious things on this image is at about the 7 o'clock position below number four, about an inch, there is something that is round.
Wheel. And it looks like it's got something in the middle. I wonder if that could be a huge antenna.
There's no telling.
It doesn't look. Do we know the angle that this part of the photograph was taken? Are we looking kind of pretty much straight down?
No, it's still oblique.
How oblique?
Not as much as the part that's on the plane above it. But, you know, you got to look at it. It's in varying degrees of obliquity because the curvature of the planet as you're going around.
Sure,
it's not
a
big planet.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is still, I would say this is probably about maybe 30%.
Okay.
You know, 30 degrees, excuse me.
Okay. So we're looking at it. Go ahead, Bob.
Just going to say, just at the 2 o'clock position above, to the right of the number four, you've got like something bridging the gap.
Oh, yes, yes. And look at that huge structure just to the east, to the 3 o'clock position of number four. Look at that.
See, that's the thing about this image. It has so much stuff in it that the more you look, the more you see. And, you know, and it gets to the point where you'll forget about stuff you saw because you see something else that's, you know, that's even more stunning.
It was so funny. Remember Alan Stern's email to all of us earlier tonight? Now, remember, Alan's the architect, so he's used to looking at terrestrial architecture, and he's been looking at some stuff on the moon. And then we introduced him to this staggering set of things 3 billion miles away on Pluto, so it's taken him a while to kind of warm up, pun intended, to the idea that this is stuff. And he sent, remember what Keith, what he said in his email? He just saw this jumble, and then suddenly it was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And his eye-brain combination got it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he said he started out wanting to look at the frozen surface and then ended up looking at the Land of Oz.
Yep.
Yeah, but it's amazing. And, you know, the reason I say, a starship thing, you know, I always look at this through terms of popular culture. If you look at number three and all the way down, I'll be darned if that doesn't look like a smashed up Battlestar laying there. Just to say what it looks like in pure speculation, the whole number three looks like a big, huge smash Battlestar just laying there in pieces, with the three being on the bridge, I guess, the front part of it.
Yeah.
It's just that shape. And we find those shapes, those wedge shapes that are like this, that are symmetrical, we find these in this chaos along Arcology Row the whole entire way. I can't wait to get the pictures of the rest of this, because rest assured, we do have pictures like this.
Well, see, now that is the perfect segue. Let's go back to Radio with Pictures, and let's segue over to Will, because I want to go to the very top of the page, and nobody mind Morella. Morella's missing her mommy, and she's, you know, her daddy's talking to a whole bunch of strangers all over the world, and he's not talking to her, so she's unhappy. Will, why don't you take us to Ceres? Because I think that big pyramid on Ceres that you're going to tell us about is an almost intact version of some of these things that we're seeing on Pluto. And if that model is correct, it means that we might be looking at flying cities, a la James Blish, Keith. And we've got a really amazing one in the form of the pyramid on Ceres. So, Will, take it away.
Okay, if you're back at Radio with Pictures, if you hit number three, you'll pull up a basic, it's the last three images we've got of what they're calling now a Hunumans. First was the Lonely Mountain, I think NASA came out with when it came. These are all from the 915 mile range. This is a third orbit before the spacecraft series now that's around at dawn is now moving down, and we're going to get hopefully some more up close pictures of it. Now, if you go to my website, whatsupinthesky.com, there I've got these two images at the top. You can get a little bit more resolution out of the ones on my website, but there's plenty of resolution here on yours. The one on the right is the newest angle we've got. We've gone over pretty extensively the first two in our last show, which mm-hmm. you can see. The new angles are just tremendous for this new imaging, and they're putting out an image a day, it seems like, and they're putting it not on the Dawn mission page, which is kind of weird. You've got to actually go to the place where they've got the PIA images. It's the planetary database. It's the latest images. You'll see under latest images, there's about four on the latest images each day, and we get a new one. I've kind of been watching them roll through, and a lot of the guys from the website watch through. But if you look at the one on the right, the far right,
yes. That's taken from it's an oblique. It's what, maybe like a 45 degree angle. The reason is when we saw the side view on the horizon of this pyramid, the slopes are about 45 degrees. So the fact that at the very top of the image, we're almost seeing the apex, the top, eclipsing the base, means we must be looking almost at that same angle, the slope angle of the pyramid, which would be roughly 45 degrees from the vertical.
Exactly. You can still see the real bright, whatever the matter is that runs down the back of it, too. It's still very bright, even from this angle.
Well, I would have said that was the front.
Would you say that's the front?
For some reason, I think that the if you go to image number two, you know, left of your image number three, that to me looks like the front, the one on the left.
Yeah, you're right.
The bright shiny stuff.
Especially if you were to put into the I think you had mentioned that you think this is possibly a flying city
Look, it doesn't belong on Ceres. It's the only one of its kind. That's a line from Star Trek. And it's sitting there, and the bottom, where it touches the surface, is a very sharp contact. There are no talus slopes. There's no rubble. Right, Keith? There's no rolling boulders coming down. It's just like it's like an inverted cake dish or cake cover or pie cover placed on the surface of Ceres right next to a very mysterious and suspicious looking crater.
Note how the center and this, the third image that we've got here, the one that's on the far right, mm-hmm. it actually is showing us in the back door. That's what the purpose of that image was for.
That's what I think. Yep.
And it's showing us, if you look at what's inside there, and what were we just looking at on Pluto along all those edges and in the centers of some of those things, it was the same stuff.
Yep.
The same patterns.
So you're agreeing with me that the stuff on Pluto could be much more smashed versions of this surviving structure, this flying arcology, this flying city sitting where it doesn't belong on Ceres. Now,
if you remember Nix now, remember the picture of Nix?
Yes.
Okay, well, we have this arcology here on Ceres. It looks like that. We have Nix that's outside of there. One of those images of the
Nix being one of the moons of Pluto. Remember, in our model, when I say our model, the Enterprise mission model, Pluto was taken from wherever it lived, and I think it lived near Ceres. In fact, Ceres may have been one of its moons originally. And then it was transported out to where it is now. And the system was built. They put a bunch of other stuff in orbit in these weird resonant orbits, including Nix, which appears to be a color image we've seen of one of these arcologies in space orbiting Pluto as a moon.
Well, on the image I was showing you, the last image that I was showing you off my page, the number four on it, it looks really very much identical to one of these also. And it's laying in the pile of junk right at the edge of Sputnik Planum, you know, halfway buried. Just like this one's halfway buried in the hillside that's beside it. You can see it. The one on Ceres, you can see it. It looks like it was literally stuck into the side of that hill.
You mean number on your image?
No, I know. I'm talking about the one we're looking on wheel side.
Oh, on Ceres. Okay.
Mm-hmm. If the one on the far right of the image.
Yeah, it looks like it came in and it buried part of itself in a hill.
and that part of it's damaged as well.
Yeah,
it's pretty.
Yes.
It's pretty evident, you know.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. Yep. So maybe, that means, go ahead.
Maybe the maybe they buried it themselves with some of the regolith, some of the dirt from this crater here. Maybe there was a reason to put it under.
No. Remember, it's 12 miles long. It's an ellipse. It's 12 miles long, and it's 5 miles high. I think it came in as slow as they could make it and as gentle, and its inertia. Think of the inertia and the mass of a city 12 miles long. Even if the anti-gravs only work partially, it would bury itself in the loose regolith up to, what, almost the apex on that side. I think it crashed. It was a controlled crash.
Look at it that way. I can see what you mean. Especially if you're looking at the first one on the left, and then you really do kind of see that how it could have came in like that. I'd imagine there'd be a little bit more kick up there, but you know, after all the time, and who knows? It's amazing
exactly.
How smooth. Yeah. It's amazing how smooth it is that going down the walls in towards that crater there. Especially the walls around it. It's amazing. It's an amazing shot. And this was one of the first ones I think that actually came out. NASA put out as, I think they called it a pyramid too.
Yes, they did. No, they call it a pyramid. Again, it's like they're pointing without saying it. They're doing everything they can without actually getting pregnant to get pregnant.
Yeah, we never called it a pyramid.
Nope.
They did. They first.
Did.
Yes.
Okay, guys, we're at the bottom of the hour. Stay tuned, because you are on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning, well, we won't go through the whole list because it would take too long and we won't get back to finish our discussion. So just stay tuned. We shall return. And we are back this morning on the other side of midnight with my guests Keith Laney and Will Farrer, Andrew Curry and Robert Harrison. Will, you were going to say something more about the flying grounded arcology on Ceres.
Well, I don't know if we've touched about, I just wanted to give the update for Ceres. I think we've touched a little bit about that now. Do you guys want to look at what started the second image I provided? This was the latest and greatest of what started the intrigue with the press and NASA releasing with the bright lights at the Akritor crater.
Mm.
They've given us, okay.
We have to go back to other side of midnight, radio with pictures. And now we click on image number 2 in Radio with Pictures, right?
Yep, number 2. And it's starting to come together, the images of this, what seems to be, I think Robert did a great job a couple shows back when we did took this on at first, and he showed the progression of it. And as we move forward, I think this is just a great view of it. Then you got the good resolution on your website too, where if you can click on it after you open it and click it again. Some of the things start to take shape. You can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It almost looks about the patches are starting to come together. There's so many more patches. There's some interesting stuff in the middle of the two main bright patches there. It almost looks like there's something coming into play there. Maybe a sort of building or something down there.
Hmm.
You guys can see that. Anybody else see that between there? It's maybe a little circular round piece. It's a little bit darker than the rest of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what you do see on this image, Will, is the overwhelming brightness of these things.
Absolutely.
I mean, you're saying the little small things that are over to the right are literally blazing at us.
Remember, the average albedo or reflectivity of Ceres is around 5%, 3%, something like that. It's very, 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 very dark, probably due to a high carbon content that will come out of the data at some point. And then you have these objects, which are stunningly bright by comparison. In fact, they're overexposed for the exposure of the rest of the Ceres surface. So whatever they're made of, and NASA's been saying salt, Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is late. This is a great enhancement, Will. Good job, buddy. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought this was, like I said, I've been serious ever since they NASA, when they put these bright lights out, and when it just when they took the mission off of their website. And I bring this up every time we talk about Ceres. When the mission came out, the bright lights hit the news, and I was able to go to the website and easily just hit missions, Dawn mission to Ceres was right there, and they took it off of that link, and now it's not there. You've got to actually go searching for these pictures. Mm. I really took more interest into it. Usually when something gets taken away, I'm like, oh man, I really pull into it, and this is one I've been staring at for a while and just wondering what could be so bright, because you're right, it is so bright. You can put it in Photoshop, drop the contrast all the way down, drop the brightness all the way down, and it still comes through.
Remember a few weeks ago they took some images that were much dimmer, that were much shorter exposures or different exposures, so they actually tried to pull up the geometry in the bright areas?
Oh, and did a very good job of it, too, I guess. Yeah.
But this shows the context. This shows the, you know, and it's sitting in the, again, Ossiter Crater on Ceres, like Sputnik Planum on Pluto, is exactly at 19.5. The center of this thing, the bright thing on the left, that's at 19.5. Why?
What's your theory, Richard?
Say again?
Yeah.
Well, we have the great red spot on Jupiter. This is the great white spot on Ceres.
Well, but the great red spot is a natural upwelling, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when they were proposing this upwelling model of salts and all that, for a while I thought, well, they might have something because it is at 19.5 and that's where you would have an upwelling. But remember, Ceres is not an active planet. It's a third the size of Pluto. It's 600 miles across. So what kind of geology could you have with an isolated body orbiting in the asteroid belt, you know, a billion or so, half a billion miles, somewhat less from the sun? So, no, if someone built this, and to me the geometry that we've seen on the other versions really show that somebody built this, they built it at 19.5 for a reason.
Why don't you give us a little brief explanation? A lot of people, I think, Richard, have tuned into your show that haven't read some of your books and haven't followed your dynamics.
Horrors. They haven't read? Okay, see, how do I do this in the few minutes we have remaining? Okay, in the hyperdimensional model, when you take a sphere, like a planet or a moon or an asteroid, and you spin it, that gives you a set of references. You've got a north pole and a south pole. You've got an axis of rotation, right? Now, if you can imagine, and we're going to assume these things are roughly spherical, Ceres is kind of spherical, if you were to imagine inside this spinning sphere a tetrahedron, a four-cornered pyramid, and you put one of the points on the north pole of your spinning object, and you're thinking of this kind of like a ghostly computer animation, so you can see the surface features whipping past as it's rotating, and you see this tetrahedron inside the body also spinning with the one point of the tetrahedron on the North Pole. The other three points would be below the equator of this spinning object, and the places where they would be, the latitude there where they would be, would be 19.5 degrees latitude, south latitude. If you take another tetrahedron and put it inside the same spinning sphere and put the point on the south pole, the other three points will extend above the equator into the northern hemisphere at 19.5 degrees. In the physics of the solar system, we find from the sun all the way out to Neptune, major atmospheric and geological events seem to occur on planets at 19.5 north or south. On the Earth, for instance, the Hawaiian Islands, the Big Island, the Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa are located at 19.5 degrees because there's a huge, what's called a mantle plume, an upwelling of lava and energy coming up from the deep mantle just above the core of the Earth that after millions of years erupts on the surface at 19.5 degrees. And if you go to other planets, you'll find on Mars, for instance, Olympus Mons, the biggest volcano in the solar system, the biggest shield volcano, is at 19.5 degrees. Keith already mentioned the Great Red Spot on Jupiter is swirling around in a gaseous atmosphere, which grades down into the planet in much higher density and higher temperature levels, because there is no solid surface on Jupiter because it's a gas giant, something like 84,000 miles across. So the pressures inside and the temperatures inside are almost star-like, tens of thousands of degrees if you get down to the core. So the energy upwelling seems to occur under this, the conditions of this physics, in a rotating body at 19.5 either north or south. Now, since that's the hallmark of the physics, since that's the major number that says that this is how the universe really functions in terms of geology and atmospherics and stellar dynamics and all that, because it doesn't matter what rotating body you're looking at, as long as there's fluids, gases or liquids, they will come up at 19.5 under the right conditions. If you're on a little place like Ceres, 600 miles across, and there's nothing fluid underneath, it's solid all the way to the core because the object is too tiny to basically heat the core to any temperatures, then if you're looking at somebody building something, out of all the places, you know, it's kind of like Casablanca, all the gin joints in all the world you had to come into mind, out of all the places that you walk up on Ceres and find this most incredible mystery, aside from the pyramid, and it's at 19.5, it says to me somebody did this. Either it was a capital city, it was the focal point of when Ceres was part of the incredibly active Type II civilization. And of course, since this civilization lived the physics like the Egyptians built in terms of their physics, their cosmology, it makes sense to me that what we're seeing are the remnants of a kind of an LA kind of structure. You know, this is about the size of the LA basin, Ossetor Crater. And the remnants we're seeing, highly geometric, are the reflective parts of the city that haven't yet been eroded or destroyed, but it was a specific sighting at 19.5 to communicate the fact that they're living in a universe where this is the physics under which they live, and they exemplified the physics in their architecture by placing their major metropolis on Ceres at 19.5. Clear?
Dead on. Thank you. I've been meaning to ask you to, I wanted you to, since I've been on the show, I've been wanting you to put that in a 5-minute thing. That's perfect.
But see, then you wouldn't read the books.
you gotta add Pluto to it too now, Richard.
Okay. So if that is clearer, to me, what we're going to find in Ossetor could be even more amazing than what we're finding at the Flying Pyramid. By the way, do we know, Will, why they're calling it Ahuna? Have you looked at the Hawaiian derivation of Ahuna? Who's Ahuna?
Let me see. I know I've looked this up before. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but I've read it. I know I've read it 10 times now. I should know off the top of my head.
Well, it's out there somewhere. So we're going to let Will go away and find out what Ahuna, because if NASA's being coy and cute, there will be some interesting meaning attaching the name Ahuna to the Flying Pyramid, the Flying Arcology. There's got to be, because they do nothing without heavily, heavily, heavily symbolic ritualization. Nothing.
Hey, Richard.
Yeah?
What do you think the material is that's some glowing like that? You think it's a crystal?
I'd say it was glass.
Okay.
Yeah, probably a special glass where, you know, it transmits energy one way and doesn't transmit energy out the other way, so you keep things warm. I mean, even if you are a super civilization, you're probably going to do things architecturally that minimize energy usage, because it's probably just part of the way things are done. You know, why be extravagant when you don't have to be?
Right.
And I think that it might be some. I don't think it's metallic. I don't think it's we're not looking at aluminum or titanium or something. I think we're looking at glass. Because remember, if this was a city, Ceres never could have had an atmosphere unless they gave it artificial gravity, in which case you would have had to have a dome city. Ossetor Crater could have actually been completely domed over. Mm. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, and this could be what we're looking at, what's falling through.
Mm-hmm.
Now I figured it out here. It's named after the traditional post-harvest festival, Ahuna, of the Sumi Naga people of India. And if I said that wrong, I apologize.
Now that's an incredibly important connection, because what terrestrial ancient civilization has the most interesting mythologies, legends, and purported ancient history of what we used to be, what we used to do?
It's a granary.
But the Indians.
Right out of India. Yeah.
The Hindu, you know, the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita. You know, remember they had flying thingies, Vimanas?
The Vimanas, yeah.
Wouldn't it be amazing if Ahuna is a huge, huge, huge Vimana?
That goes right along with your flying arc. Oh, gee.
Well, isn't that cute?
That is something else.
NASA does nothing without a deep symbolic rationale underneath the surface that 99.999% of people don't get because they don't think as crazy as you guys and I do.
Did you go set?
Okay, we got about 15 minutes left, a little less. If anybody wants to call and ask these guys a question, I'm sure there must be questions out there. You know, our numbers are very obvious, 505-796-8802. 505-796-8802, or our Skype handle is Enterprise Mission. So if you want to join the conversation, feel free. Otherwise, we got lots to talk about. Andrew, I think you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I'm coming back to Ocator Creator again and the glowing material. The only reason I bring it up is, you know, the old story about Colonel Percy Fawcett back in, was it 1925 or something. And
why don't you remind us? Because I he did a lot of interesting stuff, but maybe I'm not thinking of the same interesting stuff you are.
Yeah, he was an explorer, and he was the guy that, I guess, in his final expedition got lost. He was looking for, they think, El Dorado in the deep jungles of Brazil. But he came across, apparently, an Indian who told him of these long-dead cities that were apparently connected to the Atlantean mythology, and they were basically lit all the time. And this one Indian, I guess he came, about the square crystal on the pillar that lit the whole, you know, or they were square crystals on pillars all around this city. I'm just wondering if there's any, if we could speculate on a connection there, you know, just because this stuff was apparently glowing all the time.
Well, that brings up an interesting thing. Now, initially when NASA published their first picture of the lights in Ocator, they didn't know it was Ocator. They called it Spot Number 5, I think, in the approach images. And then they showed us, remember they showed us the rotation? And they showed that the lights go out when this thing goes into darkness, when it crosses the Terminator and whips around on the night side of Ceres. But suppose the material was active photoreactive. In other words, it's some kind of glass or glass-like material that takes sunlight and amplifies it as long as it's in sunlight.
Oh, that's interesting.
The cure for that would be for them to take a dark image of it, take a nighttime image of it.
Well, they've already done that.
Well, I thought it was dawn.
No.
I thought it was a dawn image.
No. They've taken it on the night side, and it's not visible at all, which means look, you can explain it either as enhanced reflectivity or an active photo process where you're amplifying sunlight. Remember, you're how many, half a billion miles or so from the sun? So if you wanted natural lighting, maybe if you made your domes out of materials that would amplify sunlight? You know, again, until we land and get samples, we're not going to know, or unless we find the libraries. What I find interesting, Will, is that you say they're now putting these images in a kind of a special secret file that only those people that really, 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 really want to know can take the time and trouble and have perseverance to go and find.
Yeah, absolutely. They make it kind of hard. Even the website for themselves, the Dawn Mission, doesn't seem to get updated as much. Basically, it seems the people that put out, and this is the place where I go where we have to find them. There's no database of the whole image from Dawn. I haven't found it, at least, if there is, and I've searched everywhere through all of theirs. So you've got to pick them. You know, they pick one a day, it seems like, out of there. And
what's strange about it, they're not doing it in order. Sometimes this picture was taken October 15th, but the day before one was from October 25th. You know, it seems like a very strange way to be releasing the images as well.
Okay, so this image of Ossiter and the city or whatever it is in Ossiter was taken a little over 900 miles up, right?
Yep.
What can we expect in the next 3 weeks?
Well, it should be Christmas time for what they said. We're going to be getting back some of these first mappings. I haven't heard.
How close will they get?
I think they're coming down to somewhere around 200 and something, or
235 is the number that I remember.
It's somewhere right around there.
So we'll be looking at images that could be 3 to 4 times better.
I'm wondering if it's going to be bright, too bright to take pictures from that level. It's going to be very interesting to see how they come out. They might have to really take some adjustments in the way they take these images, especially of the, you know, the Akator, with the brightness of them. I know they've been, just to get what we see here, you said they've had to adjust from reading the releases that come with them. So it's very interesting. It's a great time.
There almost seems to be, and Keith, you know, support me if I'm wrong on this, and if I'm not, you don't have to. There seems to be a kind of a competition between the Dawn team and the New Horizons team.
I'm sure there is. They're both current. They're both ongoing projects, and they're both clamoring for attention. of course. Oh, and by the way,
if they're going to flip a coin at which guy, Stern or who's the Dawn guy, the PI on Dawn? Do you remember? Chris something?
Russell.
Chris Russell. Russell. Yeah. Whether they're actually going to flip a coin, okay, you get to go first. You get to – I mean, Stern has come awfully close with this latest image strip on Pluto, and then what Will is telling us that NASA is quietly starting, you know, earlier tonight, like at what, 7 o'clock you said?
It's 7:17.
What?
7:17 p.m.
7:17 is astonishingly symbolic. You know why? 7, of course, refers to the 7 symmetry spins of a tetrahedron, and 17 is the Egyptian regenerative number, meaning to be born again, to be reincarnated, to come back.
That's Osiris.
Yeah. I mean, they're nothing they do is not without a symbolic, you know, I should get Chris Knowles back on the show. You know, 7:17, he will flip out when he finds that out. So they started their conversation at 7:17 last night on what's really on Pluto.
And it even goes as far as saying, did you miss the close-ups views of Pluto? Check out these. And yes. And the conversations are even getting more and more. It's amazing. And people going back and forth. This world is – the likes are going up on it. It's up over 10,000. So it's getting out. They've got 13 million people that have hit like on NASA's page.
You know what might be interesting? Is if you were to post something about this show – and the fact that they can hear an actual analysis of what the images are really showing. Why don't you do that? Post that and see if it's taken down or it's kept.
I will. I'm going to out there right now for my cell phone and see what we get.
Okay. Okay, gentlemen, we're getting in the final minutes of the show. Why don't we do what we did the last time? Everybody has thoughts. Why don't we start with Bob? What's your latest take on where we are and what we're seeing? And you can unmute your mic.
And I've unmuted now. Well, it's just such an exciting time, isn't it?
Isn't it astonishing?
And overwhelming as well, you know, if we had as many of the images, say, from high-rise on Mars as we wanted, we probably wouldn't know what to do with them with Ceres and the whole Pluto thing. Where we are on sort of making it go mainstream, I just wouldn't know. Because there's no way of knowing what of it. No way of knowing what other people are seeing when they see our stuff, you know, whether they're seeing liken this new Pluto stuff, whether they're seeing wreckage and possibility of ruins there, you know, because there's that oblique black and white shot in the sort of jumble zone is so it's just so suggestive.
Hey, hang on, Bob. We got a call. Somebody's calling us. They must have something to say. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Hey, the name is Bob and calling from Washington.
Bob, Washington. Meet Bob from England.
Hi, Bob.
Hello. Hey, could you guys go back over to panel 5 on the second grouping?
Okay, this is going to be interesting. Let me go
second
here.
Group down.
Hang on. Okay, so we go to radio with pictures, right?
Right.
And we go down to number 5.
Correct.
Click on that. Got it.
Okay, and if you look at the second one down and then start hitting your control plus group or on your keyboard.
Oh, just to make it bigger.
Yeah.
Okay.
So from the apex of the triangle you were talking about, if you go to 9 o'clock, that is strange. And then from that, 10 o'clock right above it.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. That's interesting. Guys, do you see this?
Yeah, I'm on it.
I have no idea how that could be natural.
There is no way that this is natural. It's
welcome to the party, Bob.
Hey, but those images, you can go to the pages on my website or visit here at the show and click on these and study them all you want, man. That's what we do this for, so other people can look at them too.
You just have to keep looking and looking and looking, and the more you look, the more you're going to see. It's just the way the human eye brain thing works.
They are beautifully done, and I will let you guys go. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Okay, final thoughts. Let's have Keith.
Well, what we're seeing here is just a lovely concurrence of the things we've wanted for years and years and years. I mean, we get these images. We've got the wonderful stuff we've got from Mars. We've got the stuff coming from Ceres. It's a flood. And we're going to ride this wave on in.
Excellent. Will, we only got 2 minutes left.
Information overload. We're going to separate the chaff, and we're going to separate what we're going to pull it out. And then we're going to keep moving forward. Stay tuned. This has only begun. Christmas time will be here soon.
Well, obviously, what I'm waiting for is for the announcement. All this is a build-up to something. The fact that, Will, I mean, such an amazingly important observation on the politics tonight. NASA encouraging rampant out-of-this-world speculation.
And allowing it.
Yep. Okay, Andrew.
Richard, yeah. First of all, I'm going to keep chasing you guys and keep chasing the imagery. But I'd also like to say one last thing. I want to thank Bob in Washington and everybody who allows us to come into their devices and into their homes and let us, you know, talk away about this stuff for 2 hours. Thank you so much.
And I second that. You know, every night we are invited all over the world into people's homes and on their devices and vehicles on... Gosh, you know, it's interesting to contemplate the different places where people are listening and following us on their screens all over the planet. Can you imagine? This could not have been done before this technology was available, and that might have been one of the pacing items for why it's waited so long, Keith, to where they actually are telling us the truth.
Yep. Had built up to a landslide.
Yep. Okay, we've got, actually we have no time left. So I want to thank my guests this morning, Robert Harrison, Andrew Curtis, Will Farrer, Keith Laney, and my ever-present producer, Scott McKay, hovering there in the background. This is only the beginning. As our panel has told you again and again, this is the beginning. I have a feeling that maybe before the end of the year, given how the president is trying to keep time, to stay the course, to not change anything, maybe this will be the game changer that changes everything. So, until tomorrow morning, same time, same station, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.